So it's a really great pleasure to have with us today Annabel Croft, a truly, truly remarkable person, a remarkable sports person, a remarkable presenter, a remarkable public figure, a remarkable dancer, a remarkable mother, and one of Annabel's wonders is that she was mother of three fantastic, fantastic Wellington young people. And so let's just begin there. Annabel, I don't know the answer to this. Why did you choose Wellington? Why did you and Mel choose Wellington College?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Anthony, for having me on. And what a wonderful introduction. I think I might have to expand the doorway so that my head can fit through them after such a lovely introduction. But I will tell you very clearly the answer to that question. The reason I chose Wellington for my three children was because I heard you speak. And I came down, I was looking at lots of different schools. And without wanting to swell your head, I heard you speak and I thought, I want my children to have some of what you had to offer. And I just thought you had such a great outlook on life and a great perspective on what the school had to offer, what direction, you know, the children could take. And there are so many directions, I'm sure, that children, I always want children to have every opportunity, but also to find what makes them tick, to find what makes them happy, and to try everything. And I came away from your talk and I thought, I want my kids to have some of that. So thank you for that, because they really got everything they could possibly ever had from the school.
Well, that's very lovely to hear, Annabel. If I knew that was the reason, I most certainly would not have asked that question. And but the school was the beneficiary of very much of the three, very different. And that's something I hope that Wellington does. Well, this podcast is going out not just in the UK to Wellington family and parents and pupils and grandparents and staff, etc., but also to the Wellington schools around the world. And because tennis is truly played around the world, to what extent is tennis, I don't know the answer to this also, growing? And we've got schools in Thailand and schools, for example, in China, schools in India. We're growing across the world, including in Africa. Why is tennis played more in the traditional countries, Australia, France, United States, etc.? And to what extent is it growing? I don't know.
I think tennis is growing. It's an incredibly popular sport because it's very gladiatorial. And people like to watch. It's like old-fashioned gladiators, but with sort of rackets instead of weapons in your hand, isn't it? And you get these warriors that will go up against each other. And as an audience, it's a great spectator sport because you're going to see not just skill and athletic ability. There's a little bit of artistry in tennis. Everybody plays different styles, even though they're doing forehands, backhands, serves, volleys, drop shots. Everybody brings a little bit of their personality into the way that they play tennis. And then there's many pressure moments that ride through the course of a match. So as an audience, you can ride those pressure moments with the two players. You can kind of dip into what's going on psychologically. It's a very psychological game. And there's a lot to enjoy watching it. So I think tennis is incredibly popular. And we've just been through this absolutely extraordinary era of great, great champions, you know, with Roger Federer with 20 Grand Slams, Rafael Nadal with 22. We've got Novak Djokovic sitting at the top of that tree with 24 Grand Slams. We had Serena Williams, obviously, with 23. She didn't quite match Margaret Court. But I can understand why tennis is growing, because people like to engage with it and they like to pick their gladiator and enjoy the sport.
And will it come into and grow more in China? And is it in India, for example, the two most populous countries in the world? And so much potential there for growth. And is the growth of paddle helping or handicapping tennis?
That is a very, very good question, Anthony. I think tennis definitely in China is massively popular and they have a lot of great players coming through. They've taken a lot of coaches from different parts of the world down there to try and really impart their knowledge with the players. We're seeing more and more players coming through and doing extremely well, certainly in India as well, all over the world, to be honest. So there's lots of markets opening up. But going on to paddle, I love paddle. And I don't know if you've had a chance to play it, but it's a fun game. It's easier to pick up the technicalities of it, much easier than tennis. Tennis is, I would say, more difficult, and it's played on a much bigger court. But paddle is quite social. You have a lot of fun rallies. You have to be quite fit. You know, it's quite, you have to have a lot of agility. But I play paddle with all my three kids, so we play it on holiday quite a bit. And I don't think it will be a threat to tennis because of the history of the game of tennis. You know, it's going to take a long time for paddle to kind of build up to where something like an event like Wimbledon is at. But anyway, I think it's a fun sport. And I think all these sports are great for everybody to engage in, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And sport is surely one of the human activities that's going to grow and grow in the world of AI, because it has everything going for it. And it's something that develops and enhances our humanity when AI is taking over so much of what human beings have done. Now, the questions I'm going to be asking, the good questions I'm going to be asking are from the students, pupils at Wellington, including our superb tennis players. Tennis is on a high at Wellington, including Charlie Tate and others. And I will highlight them a bit, but not too much, because they're so much better than my questions. And the best questions, just take it from me. And about the best questions coming up will be from the pupils. Now, let's just hear a bit about how you developed as a serious tennis player. And at what age and what was it that made you realize that you were not just good, but there was something very special about you? Was it somebody?
That's very kind of you to say that. Well, I picked up a racket on a family holiday in Spain, and I say this a lot. I think it's really important for teachers or for coaches or whatever you're imparting knowledge to children to have a good sense of humour. That's something you've got in abundance. And I had this wonderful tennis coach in Spain at the hotel who had a great sense of humour. And I think it gives an ability for a child to engage with that subject because you just enjoy it and it's fun. So I loved tennis when I first picked up a racket. And bearing in mind, picking up a racket at age 9 is quite late by today's standards. Now, normally kids are picking them up if they want to be pros by about 4 or 5, believe it or not. But anyway, I came back from that holiday. I absolutely loved it. And then found a local club in Kent. My mum found me a local sort of tennis community club. And can you believe this? The sessions were 50p. I had 50p in my pocket, and that was going to pay for the lesson that day. And again, I just absolutely loved it. And then from that moment on, practiced every day, organized my own sessions, started to enter into tournaments. And then my uncle took me to Wimbledon to watch Virginia Wade play against Chris Evert in the semifinals in 1977. That was the year that she won Wimbledon. She's the last remaining British woman to do so. And again, I think it's so important to take kids to anything live, whether it's sport, music, drama, theatre, dance. It gets into your bones, doesn't it? And I can still remember sitting at the back of the stands and my uncle took me to watch that match. And that was when I thought, I want to play at Wimbledon. And, I think it's inspirational and motivating.
And a question from our tennis playing pupils here. Before the big games, how did you, as a youngish woman, girl, how did you prepare? How did you calm yourself? What advice can you give?
Well, I wish I had had more advice myself, actually, because I was someone who suffered very badly from nerves. And when nerves present themselves in tennis, your arms and your limbs just have so much adrenaline running through them. You find it very difficult to release the racket head, and your legs stop working, your feet stop working. So everything becomes a little bit stilted and stuttery. But the advice I was always given was to run a lot in the warm-up, just to release all the adrenaline and try and run as much as possible in run for every ball and get rid of it, because it's all starting to lock up your body. But also, I've learned over the years that you have to distract the mind. And by distracting the mind has this monkey brain, voice that's in your head that starts to sort of talk negatively about, oh, gosh, what if this happens or what if that happens? And all the time that that's happening, it's wasting the positive thoughts that you could be having about being in the present. And so I've learned over the years that if you start to worry about all these things, it's already too late. So you have to block all those negative thoughts and just be in the moment. And that is one of the most difficult things to do. But I think when we look at the great champion that maybe hopefully your peoples will know about, Rafael Nadal, a great Spanish player, he was always a player that was able to not think forward, not think back, but play every point on its merit, because only a match can be won one point at a time. So you can't be thinking, oh, what happens, if I don't win this service game, or what about that terrible shot I've just had and hit, and start dwelling on the bad stuff that you just did. You can only ever think of the moment and the next point in front of you. So it's one of the most difficult things to do, but if they can do it, it's really effective.
Such brilliant advice for tennis players and for netballers, rugby, cricket, but even going into an exam. I mean, if you think you did a bad question, forget it. Just go on to the next. Keep that in mind. So that was a masterclass there in meditation or mindfulness. And
there's one other thing I'd like to say. So at Wimbledon, when you go through the main clubhouse doors, first of all, you go through this wonderful hallway and you have the several of the trophies, the singles of both the men's and the ladies, all the doubles, the juniors, all the trophies are presented. And then you look at the doors in front of you and it goes straight out onto center court. But above the doors, before the players walk out onto center court, is this wonderful Rudyard Kipling poem, If, which you probably are very familiar with. And they have this one saying at the top of the entrance to that centre court. And it says, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. And I love that saying, because in life, I think sport mirrors life. You're not always going to win everything. There's going to be many ups and downs. There's going to be hurdles to overcome, challenges along the way. And I think if every child can engage in sport, learn the difference between winning and losing, but to treat it the same, that you have humility when you lose a tennis match. And tennis players lose a lot of matches. You're never going to win every match you play. Even Novak Djokovic has said that he only wins just over maybe half the matches he plays. But I love that saying, because I think that when those players look at that saying and they go out onto center court, you go out, you do battle, you shake hands, you respect your opponent, and you go back to the locker room and you might go and have a chat, but you've gone and given your all out there, but you should never be afraid to lose. And I think you should treat it with respect. That's my opinion. And that's why I'll have to show it to you one day, Anthony. We'll have to take you to Wimbledon.
I would love to see it. Up there, Annabelle.
I'll have to take you, and
it's such a great, oh my goodness, it's such a great poem. And he was one thing that you share in common with Rudyard Kipling is you were both Wellington College parents, and I have to say that you would be ranked many tiers above Rudyard Kipling, who was far from an ideal parent with his boy John or Jack, who was killed in the First World War, tragically. But it's a remarkable for today's all of us, what he writes in If and elsewhere. So your own journey upwards is what were the major staging posts on your as a player to your pinnacle of your career?
I suppose, what did you say? What was the main
staging posts?
Okay. Well, I suppose I went to live in America when I was 15, because it was a big decision. After I played my very first Wimbledon at 15, can you believe it? I was the youngest player at Wimbledon for 95 years. So I played in the seniors at 15. And after that, which was a huge dream come true. But after that, I then went and made a massive decision to go and live in America in my coach's house and train in much hotter conditions because it was much closer to playing in tour-like conditions, you know, with 80% humidity and over 100 degrees. I then went on to the main tour, which takes a bit of time to get up there because you have to go and travel around the world, playing in different venues, not many people watching, traveling around on buses, cheapest way to get across America. But once I got onto the main tour, then life changes again. I won a tour event in San Diego, which was a very proud moment for me. I beat somebody who was number four in the world in the final. But I did it on my own. There was nobody there watching me. I was traveling on my own at the time. I think one of the most exciting moments for me was playing at the Albert Hall representing Great Britain in what was called the Whiteman Cup. I won a match there against the American player, Alicia Molik. And actually, in hindsight, when I look back on my career, winning Junior Wimbledon and the Junior Australian Open and being in those trophy cabinets, even though I didn't win the seniors, it's actually still a really proud moment for me. And I think, you know, something that I guess I can always be in the trophy cabinet, always show people when I take them to the club. When I take you there, I'll be able to show you the trophy. So,
An extraordinary moment, and the country was so incredibly proud of you and the encouragement you gave to so many other players at the time. Remember it well. I mean, you were a phenomenon, and up you went. What was your aspiration having won at the junior level?
I suppose when you've won juniors, your aspiration is to win the seniors, isn't it? So yeah. I knew there was a huge gulf of difference between going from juniors into seniors. And I think when you've won a lot as a junior, you're used to winning. And then when you hit the main professional tour, everybody on that tour is a pro and they hammer every weakness. And your every single match you're playing is the equivalent and 10,000 times more than just a junior tournament. So I wish that I had dealt with the losses a little bit better. And I wish that I had understood that life is a process and it goes in chapters and that I just needed to bide my time and learn from the defeats rather than taking it personally and putting myself down all the time. And I wish that I had approached my tennis and just thought, actually, the wins and the losses are just a process. And actually, all it's about is every time you step on court, trying to be a better player, trying to improve 1% in everything that you're doing. Even if you lose the match, did I return serve better today? Did I concentrate for longer today? Did I move better today? And you can look at every aspect of tennis and think, where are the improvements that I could do? And not judge yourself by just the results. And I know it's something that Carlos Alcaraz, believe it or not, he's had a child psychologist since he was about eight. But everything that he worked on was about enjoyment of the process of trying to be a better tennis player rather than judging himself by winning or losing tennis matches, which I think is a really big difference. And otherwise, if you don't always win, you're going to put yourself down and lose confidence and think that you're a disaster or, you know, you're defeating yourself. Whereas if you can look at it from a completely different perspective of positivity and concentration and focus, it's a whole different mindset approach, isn't it? But
It's such a great philosophy and it's such a great message to give out to, all the parents and everyone else listening to this, as well as the young people about the way to live a good life. And I mean, sport has more lessons than for us all, than dare I say it, than our politicians and prime ministers. I mean, good of thought, hey? What a shock. What a shock. And so on that top level professional circuit, just a word about how friendly you were with the other players. And was it bitter or was it mutually supportive or a mixture? What was it like?
It was a mixture, but I would say on the whole, it's pretty cutthroat and brutal. And everybody out there on the tour is your rival and your enemy. It's difficult to have friends on the tour because if you go and have dinner with somebody and you offload what you're really feeling inside, and I'm quite an open person, so I like to share how I'm feeling and be honest, suddenly you'd find you were playing that person the next week. And so you've just let your guard down and you've let them into your world. So I found it very difficult to, I did have friends who were very lovely people, actually, and I kind of gravitated towards them. But I think it's more difficult to have a normal life. I think it's a very
interesting.
I think it's a very unnatural world on the tennis tour. It's like a, I call it like a Cirque du Soleil. You're just traveling around like a circus, going to different hotels, different airports, different venues. And you don't have a sense of real normality. And you don't have a sense of where does tennis fit in the bigger picture of life. You know, I was too young to understand it.
Two more questions on your career. Who was the greatest tennis player that you played against?
I would say the greatest player I played was Martina Navratilova. And tell us about that,
Annabel.
Well, Martina was from the Czech Republic, and then she took on American citizenship. She was a left-handed player who was phenomenally talented, and she played a very aggressive game style, which was very different to what we'd seen before. She was just serving and volleying and coming forward, taking the ball out of the air. And people were struggling to stay on court with her for more than 40 minutes. She was just incredible. And I played her several times on the tour, but she was a great, great champion. And, you know, she won multiple Grand Slam titles. She won in mixed doubles. She won in doubles as well. And she also took the game to new heights with fitness training. Everybody in the past had just played tennis and they hadn't really focused on the fitness side of things, whereas Martina was the first one really to bring in proper outside physical training and diet as well. She started looking at dietitians and nutritionists, and she really upped the way professionalism was on the tour. So it was a privilege to play against her. And her great rivalry, as we mentioned before, was Chris Evert, who I also absolutely adored and looked up to. And I ended up playing her at Wimbledon in the third round. But I would say the two of them had probably the greatest rivalry we've seen in women's tennis. And there hasn't really been a rivalry that's compared to that one since. Yeah,
absolutely. And what was it that made you decide to give up as a player?
Well, I gave up and I retired off the tour. Can you believe this? At age 21. But at 21, I had lived the life of somebody probably about 35. And I, as I explained, I'd been traveling since I was 12. And I'd been on the tour going round and round the globe, living out of a suitcase. And I just had decided that I had done everything I wanted to do in the sport. And I could see the pathway ahead was going to be just living this sort of nomadic lifestyle out of a suitcase, and happiness was going to depend on winning tennis matches and to have no friends and no real social life. And I just wanted to explore life more outside it. And I've never regretted that decision. It was an instinctual thing. I think you must always follow your gut. And my gut was very much telling me that I needed to change direction and move to something different. And that was quite scary because I was walking away from 5-year contracts. I'd signed up racket deals, shoe contracts, clothing deals, patch deals. But I walked away from 5-year contracts, but I knew that I just didn't want to go down that pathway. I never fell out of love with tennis, but I just knew I didn't want to live that lifestyle. And what I call in combat or in an antagonistic way going forward. So I think it was the right decision for me. But of course, I've ended up covering the sport for about 30 years from a broadcaster perspective.
We'll come on to that. Now, it's incredibly, incredibly brave at 21. I mean, do you ever look at Emma Raducanu and think and see yourself in her at all? Or is her trajectory so different?
Well, there are similarities, but you'd have to times by about 1,000 what happened to me. After I won Junior Wimbledon and the Junior Australian, I was starting to live a very adult life with lawyers, contracts being put in front of me, sponsors. It was the first time in my tennis career that even before that, I was responsible for me. So everything I did, I was responsible for. Suddenly, I've got all these contracts and sponsors asking me, what's your ranking? Why did you lose that match this week? Who are you playing next week? What's going to be your ranking next week? So the pressure was enormous. And it was the first time I'd felt that. But you can imagine Emma Raducanu.
Well, you won the junior. She won an Open. Yeah. You know, both very young. Ages, and whether winning so young can in some ways create its own problems and difficulties.
I think it can. And I think, I don't know how many contracts she signed up after winning the US Open, but she came as a rank outsider through the qualifying, won 10 matches without dropping a set. I think she signed up. It was rumoured to be something like 24, 27 contracts straight after that. I can't imagine the pressure that was on her, because each one of those contracts would want a piece of her. They'd want time in her diary, which would eat into training time. And they would also be asking questions. They want results. They would be expecting something back for the money that they're paying. So, I can understand why life changed for her dramatically, and life will never be the same for her. But that would have been an enormous amount of pressure, to be able to perform for all those contracts.
So, back with you and moving into commenting and then presenting. I mean, how does that, was that a very natural segue for you?
Not at all. When I first came off the tour, there were only four channels. So the sports channels didn't exist. So Sky Sports didn't exist. Eurosport didn't exist. And I had to try and sort of make a living, but I was enjoying exploring things. And the very first phone call I got was from, it was a Janet Street Porter program called Network 7. And I got a phone call, and they were going to do a strand on there called Survival. And I got a phone call from a producer who said, would you like to go and be a cave woman on a desert island in Sri Lanka with three men? And I remember he thought, oh, yeah. That sounds quite good fun. And there was no health and safety in those days. And they just dropped me off on this desert island. And one of them was an actor called Simon O'Brien from Brookside. The other was a Parkhurst prison inmate having done time for armed robbery. And then the other person was a city stockbroker. Anyway, they just gave us all different walks of life. So I was sort of representing women and sport. And they just gave us a machete knife and a roll of loo paper and a tinderbox. And they just basically said, survive. And they dumped us off there. It was monsoon season. We had no camp, nothing. And we spent 10 days there and we had no food. There was just a well to drink the water out of. It was a very interesting existence because I literally was living like a caveman. But many, many years later, a gentleman came up to me at a cocktail party and he said, you won't remember me. I was a runner on that show you did on the island. And he said, what you don't realize is we based the whole of Get Me Out of Here on that program. And basically I was the guinea pig for it.
It sounded very similar. And so what an evolution from that. But the confidence that you had in front of the camera and your ability to speak, I mean, what was the first big tournament that you were commenting on?
Well, the commentary came in much, much later. And I did a little.
And how?
I did some pantomimes. And that was the first time that I'd stood on stage and tried to use a microphone and use my voice. And, I sort of look back at that now and realize that that was a piece of the jigsaw puzzle in what I do now. But I wouldn't have known that at the time, which is why for young people, it's really good to go and explore all avenues and never be afraid to fail. So go and put yourself in uncomfortable situations where you feel uncomfortable. You might be a bit nervous about it. And when I used to be asked to make speeches, I used to almost hyperventilate and have a panic attack about having to speak publicly in front of people. And all these things come with experience, but also preparation. And I started to learn once I got the opportunities to do commentary, and I'd never done commentary in my life. And the only way to do it is to be put into the deep end and swim and try and have a go. And I was very, very fortunate that I had people who were very experienced who passed on their knowledge to me. And that doesn't always happen today, I don't think. But I was lucky that some people took their headsets off, switched off the microphones and said to me, Annabelle, stop telling me it's a good backhand and now tell me why it's a good backhand. I had a producer that pulled me aside one day and ripped me to shreds. And he ripped everybody on the program to shreds. He ripped the sound engineers, the VT operators, graphics people. He was having a go at everybody, and I was next in line. And at the time, I was sort of a bit of a wobbly lip and thinking, oh, I feel like I might burst into tears with this criticism that is really harsh. And then I thought about it, and I had this 50-50, it was like a sliding doors moment. And I thought, I need to put my ego to one side, stop worrying about what the criticism is, and actually listen to the information that's coming at me. And his information was really significant and important. And I think because I was able to take on board, put aside my emotions and you know, think that what he's telling me is going to make me a better broadcaster. And I look back at that as one of the most defining moments in my career, which enabled me to go on and do way more broadcasting. And I think if I hadn't listened, I don't think I'd have been able to do the broadcasting that I've done.
And come back to your resilience at the end. I just want a quick word about a question about here, again, coming from students, your favourite commentators. And what does it need? What do you need to be a great commentator of the ladies or the men's game?
I think to be a good commentator is what I call layering your answers and enabling the audience to learn from the information that you're giving. But there's different roles in commentary. So for me, I'm what's called a color commentator, which means you're an ex-player and you have to talk over the replays, impart your knowledge, look at the tactics. But you can't just say what the audience is saying. You can't just say, oh, well, that was a great backhand. You now got to tell them why it was a good backhand or why was that point won in the way that it was won and try and describe what's happening with the technicalities or the tactics. But the other thing is, I think when I'm broadcasting, I always say to people, you never, rule number one is you never bring yourself into the interviews. So when I'm interviewing somebody, it's all about me passing the ball to the recipient or the player and getting the information out of that player to teach the audience who are listening to them. So if I'm interviewing Carlos Alcaraz, I want to get a very quick question in. Carlos, tell us how you won the match. And now he's going to tell the audience how he won the match. It's not me saying, Carlos, you played so well today, didn't you? Then he can only just go, yes, I did. It's not going to be very interesting. I want him to work his answer. So I want him to say, how did you win that match, Carlos? And he now has to tell us.
It makes perfect sense. And it is what the good teachers do also. They get the pupils to do the talking and do the thinking and explaining and in a totally similar way. A question that may be too difficult to answer, but who have been your favourite people to talk to, players, and who, and you can give an example of just an awkward one without being indiscreet. Actually, be indiscreet. It's much more fun.
Well, I think there are, you know, when you're interviewing somebody, and sometimes we only have three questions to ask a player, we're only allowed three because they have so many different broadcasters that they have to speak to. So if I say to a player, you know, tell us how you won today, and if that player goes, well, I played great, and that's all you get. And I've had a few of those, but...
Tell us.
Well, I think if the player... I mean, I think your pupils might be too young to remember, but Stan Wawrinka, who I liked very much as a player... If he wasn't in the mood, he would be one that what I call throws away his answer. I think Nick Kyrgios would enjoy making interviewers squirm a little bit, but I also think he's actually a brilliant broadcaster himself and quite fun. So that was always a challenge. My favourite, believe it or not, and he's never been the most popular player, but I think he's the most intelligent, intellectual, and by far the most interesting to interview, is Novak Djokovic. He is so fascinating. He is so unbelievably professional, detailed in every aspect of his life, leaves no stone unturned, and deserves to be where he's at in the game. And when you consider he grew up in a war-torn country with bombs going across and having to go into an air raid shelter every night with his family, wondering whether they'd survive the night, you start to understand why he's won as many tennis matches as he has, because he can put it into context.
Again, adversity, triumph over adversity. That paradox with him, not the most charming exterior, but deep thinking, is very unusual. And let's come through now to presenting at on finals day. How did that come about?
Well, do you know, exactly where I'm sitting right now in my kitchen was where I was sitting when I got the phone call from Wimbledon at about 7 o'clock in the evening one night. And I just got a phone call from them saying, would you like to host our ceremony for us? And I was so blown away by the invitation. I was quite shocked. But it was such an honor to be asked to do it because it's such an enormous event. I mean, it's watched by a global audience of probably billions. And it was quite terrifying to think about doing it. But equally, I was so proud to be asked. And also, I'd done many similar jobs, but not on that scale. So I'd interviewed at the O2 many times for many, many years. I've interviewed all around the world in different big events and tournaments. And I felt like all of that had come together to be able to be asked with experience. I think you earn that, don't you, through your what you put out over a number of years, probably 20, best part of 20 years. It felt like, wow, all those night shifts I've done and all the hours and hours of broadcasting has led to this moment. I was very lucky.
Tell us about the first time. And again, more people questions here about managing nerves. And just tell us about...
Yeah. Well, I think it was utterly terrifying, but equally I went into what I call almost like a professional mode of I've done this so many times before, and it was all about the preparation. So I absolutely prepared for those interviews, and I led up to those interviews for many months, actually. And sometimes I'd be lying in bed at night thinking, oh, what about if I ask this question? And I'd write it down. And over a period of about 3 months, I kept thinking of different ways to ask the questions, what would be the best way to get the best information out of the players. But equally, even though I collated so many different ways of asking questions in that moment, you often always go back to the simplest way and, you know, with the least amount of words and just get the players talking.
So and remind us of the players on that first one. The first year?
Well, the first year I had Ons Jabeur to start with because she was the first Arabic woman to reach the finals of Wimbledon and lost in that final. But she started crying and it was a very emotional moment because I had to think on my feet about whether I allowed her just to settle herself or did I give her a hug or did I say, don't worry about it, go back, you know, just don't worry about it. But I gave her that moment and actually it came good because she started to speak and obviously she was much, much loved figure and it worked out really well. And then Vondrousova, the player from the Czech Republic, she won that particular day and she gave a great interview actually. But again, I'd really, really prepared how we were going to talk about things. And then I had Novak Djokovic, who'd lost that great, great epic final in five sets to Carlos Alcaraz. But, you know, Djokovic spoke so beautifully and he was so gracious in defeat and he brought a little bit of humour in and he's so experienced. And actually it ended up being a really fun interview. And then, of course, Carlos Alcaraz after that. So I would say those four interviews, which came back to back, were... Yeah, they went as well as I could have hoped that they could have done. So, yeah, I was very, very fortunate, really.
It was, it's extraordinary watching it and, you know, thinking about the theatre of it all and the royal family and the role that was played by the wife, sadly died this year, of our college president, who is the Duke of Kent, the Duchess of Kent. So are you looking forward? What's going to happen this coming summer?
Well, I will be doing it again, and I will continue to kind of think about ways to do it or try to improve it and try to get the best out of the players. So I'm really looking forward to it again. And I always look forward to Wimbledon. I think it's the greatest tournament in the world. It's such a privilege to be part of it, part of the broadcasting team, and also to host those ceremonies again. And I'm excited to see who we get in the finals once again. But yeah, definitely looking forward to it.
Any tips, Annabelle?
Oh, well, I think in men's tennis, it's hard not to predict that we might get another Alcaraz-Sinner men's final. But in the women's, it's always wide open. Hard to predict. I really have no clue who's going to get into the final. And grass is such a specialised surface. You know, it usually favours people with a little bit more creativity or a slice backhand or big serving. So, but the women's game is way more wide open than the men's. It's much more difficult to predict.
And will our doubles ever capture the imagination of the broadcasters, the public, the sponsors in the way that the singles does? And if not, why not?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And when I grew up, the doubles was very much a part of the tour. And we were very familiar with the doubles players and they became household names and it had a huge audience. Whereas now it seems to be because of the demands of the tour and the way it's moved on with its physicality and, you know, the injury problems that all the players have, it's almost impossible for the big names to play singles and doubles. I mean, they try a little bit of it, but they don't commit 100% to every single tournament. And, you know, we've had some fantastic success in Britain with the doubles players. We've had a wonderful coach, Louis Kaya, that's been helping those doubles players become world number ones, win Grand Slam titles. I mean, we've had a list of players that keep on winning slams. So that should keep the interest going, certainly at Wimbledon. But I think it's a really good question. I'm not sure at the moment, the way that it's set up, whether the broadcasters, I mean, they've tried at the US Open last year. They had Raducanu playing with Alcaraz, but it was more of an invitational event. But I just hope that it does, because actually we need doubles to be a part of the development of singles players. So if lots of your players at Wellington that are engaging in singles, they should definitely play doubles to develop their singles games as well.
And excellent advice. Last question area is your resilience. And the resilience that you spoke about there and... You've the last time we spoke, you'd just been mugged coming back from the French Open and in front of an audience at Epsom College. And you bounced back. I mean, everyone was just amazed by your bounce back. And then on a, you know, infinitely more serious level, the loss of Mel, your husband. Is your resilience, is it learnt or were you born with it, do you think?
Oh, I don't, that's so interesting. I've never been asked that. I wonder whether it's just in me. I think I have a positive outlook and I think in life it's really important to take responsibility for your own actions and to make things happen yourself. And I always said this to my three kids when they were young, that never wake up in the morning and expect that somebody out there is saying, oh, let's help Annabelle today, because no one is out there doing that. You know, you create your own luck and you make things happen for yourself. And, you know, I'm always somebody that says we should go back to more old fashioned ways of going in and meeting people for a coffee or a lunch or whatever, just to get conversations going. I used to make lists for myself of people I wanted to meet or people I needed to contact, and not just always relying now. Young people always rely just totally on digital things, like text message or email. We need more interaction and contact with people, because out of those conversations, and I can relate this to tennis. In tennis, we're picking up body language, or we're picking up on a different level when we're talking to somebody, aren't we? We engage with people so much more when we're in front of them. So I think it's quite important to do that, and for young people to really make things happen for themselves, but to also not blame anyone, but to take responsibility. And if you know, negative things happen or things don't always go your way, you learn from them. And you always learn more from your defeats in tennis than you ever do from a win. So it's always about your response to the defeat or your response to something negative that happens is the most important thing. Because it's that we don't have that much time here, so we may as well try and make the most of it while we're here.
That is just wonderful advice for everybody. And I'm going to leave that there just as the last memory in people's minds. And thank you so much. And the Wellington community adores its tennis. And chair of governors, as you know, has become chair of the Lawn Tennis Association, William Jackson. And from that level all the way down. And you are, Annabel, a total inspiration to us all in this community, as you are to communities in this country and across the world. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. And very best of luck to all the pupils. And I really hope that they enjoy the podcast. Thank you. Thank you for having me.